Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Emily Howes about her historical novel, The Painter's Daughters. Emily has worked as a storyteller, theatre maker, performer, writer and director in stage, television and radio. Her short stories have been shortlisted for several awards, and she won the Miss Lexia Novel Award in 2021. In addition to writing fiction, Emily works as a psychotherapist and she lives in London with her children. In this episode, we discuss using present tense in historical fiction, trying to sustain tension in the saggy middle of a novel, and what theatre class taught her about writing through the body. But before we hear that, here's Emily with an excerpt from The Painter's Daughters.
And so we are banished and hurry from the room, my hands still dripping. Together we slip back through the hallway, past the carefully hung portraits that say, look what happens here, look who you can be. Two small girls vanishing like twin ghosts up the stairs, off to find another game, another way to pass the time. We are invited in together, we are conspirators together, welcomed, banished, summoned, always together. And when Molly forgets, I remember for her. Later, when the canvas is smooth and dry, unmarred and unmarked and ready, it will show us how to paint the first layer, a rich ochre red, the colour of earth and blood all mixed up together. Because the earth colour will not kill the other colours, he tells us, and we think it is funny, the red letting all the other colours live. Red for justice, virtue and defence, green for hope, carnation for subtlety and deceit, popinjay for wantonness, hidden messages to warn, to praise, to flatter, each one blended into the edge of a ribbon or the fall of light from the sun. It is a form of magic that only he knows. Ever since those early days, I have thought of colours as having their own life, their own agency, as if they are characters in a story clamouring to be heard. Now I am the kind of green you get in shadows, terra verte perhaps, the muted underpaint. That is what secrets do. But as a child in our Ipswich days, I was pink, the tender pink of flesh, pale and iridescent against the dark Suffolk earth. And Molly too. We were the same colour then.
Hi, Emily. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, The Painter's Daughters.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. I'm such a fan.
Thanks, Emily. Can you start by telling us what The Painter's Daughters is all about?
Yes, so it is the story of Peggy and Molly Gainsborough, who are the daughters of Thomas Gainsborough, the portrait painter. It's a historical fiction book. They lived in the 18th century. And what's fascinating about Peggy and Molly is that, first of all, they were painted again and again by their dad, and the portraits are just absolutely stunning and gorgeous and intimate and tender. They're really wonderful to write from, but also they have this story that nobody really knows about them, which is that Molly started to suffer from mental instability and that Peggy, the younger sister, became her carer. And I don't want to say what happens in the end, but the story is really one of how much we're prepared to or should be able to sacrifice for each other, for love.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's such an interesting, there's so many interesting sort of true elements to the story. But I wondered how you discovered it. What was your kind of moment where you heard about the story and thought, okay, there's potential here for a novel?
So I knew the paintings, but I'd never been a huge Gainsborough fan. I mean, I always thought he was a bit anemic, and I just thought of these high society portraits that were very, I don't know, very sort of delicate, and the women looked very delicate, and I was more sort of attracted to bolder figures in art and more dramatic scenes in art. And but then I happened to just wander around an exhibition at the National Gallery, and it was of his family and friends, so it was all the people he knew in his life, and the portraits, and they were very different to the portraits that we know him for, which he actually didn't really love painting. He was kind of a landscape guy, and he became quite frustrated by having to do all these beautiful aristocratic portraits, and there were these this I think they gathered together all the portraits of the girls when they were small for the exhibition, and you could just see this whole lovely world of this kind of very natural, very tender, intimate, close sisterly relationship. There's one where they're holding a cat and the cat's kind of trying to break free, so you just see the shadow of this cat in movement, and they've got their arms around each other, and there was something really lovely about them. And then there was another giant picture next to them, which was the girls as adults. And it was life-size, huge show picture, and they looked so different. They looked like they'd been kind of built from the outside in, completely enveloped in their fashion, and the relationship just looked so different. And there was one in the middle of them as painters, which they didn't become. So I was thinking, what's gone on? What's gone on in this gap? So it was kind of the gap between paintings that made me go over and look at the plaque and find this story. And then as soon as I had the story, I just thought, oh, that would make such a great novel or something. I just really wanted to write about them.
Yeah, that intrigues me when you say you read it and you knew it had to be something. So what was the process then? Did you kind of go home, do some more reading, do some scribbling down? What was the process? Did you kind of think in your head, this is going to be a novel? Because I know you've written short stories, you've worked in the theatre. Did you always think novel in your head, or was there other explorations?
No, I thought radio play. Partly because I'd worked in that field before, so that was kind of where I used to work in theatre and radio, and I thought, well, I could just try it. And then I wrote a sort of structure for it, and I started to experiment with a kind of narrator to guide us through the story. And when I took it to a radio producer that I worked with previously, she was like, this should be a novel. And the passages of the prose really leapt out at her, and she's like, have you thought about expanding it into a novel? And that it just seemed overwhelming at the time. I'm much more of a short form. I thought I was much more of a short form person. Theatre is all very immediate. There's no kind of sitting alone with a laptop for a year or two. So I thought I probably couldn't do it. Had a bit of a go at it, put it aside, and then thought, no, I'm going to give it one big push and try the Curtis Brown novel writing course. And once I was on that, then I kind of felt I just wanted to get over the finish line.
Yeah, oh, amazing. I have to ask you this now. I was going to ask you later, but I'll ask you now. Had you ever written a novel before or even thought about writing a novel? Not at all,
No,
no.
no, I just thought it would be, to be honest, when I started, I thought just to be able to write the end, just to get to the end of a novel would be so wonderful. I just didn't think I would have the ability to hold the shape of the whole thing, or to be honest, honestly, I think it's a battle with your own confidence, really. And once I began to realize that, I became quite committed to the idea of winning that battle and becoming somebody who could do it, rather, and to just shout down the voices in my head that were saying, oh, you can't do this, oh God, what do you think you're doing, just put it away, it's not for you. So once I could hear them, I was like, you are not winning this.
And
I will triumph.
it's so, I mean, like you say, to kind of push yourself to get over that hurdle of the amount of words that it takes to write a novel. And I think so many people just don't finish, and it's so hard because you see, people who have written 30,000, 40,000, and you think, well, you're almost there, like just keep going. But it's easier said than done. I mean, we've all been there, struggling away. So tell us a little bit more then about the dynamic between the sisters, because the novel's mainly told through Peggy or Margaret's eyes. Why did you decide to tell it through kind of her perspective and not Molly's?
I did experiment with a little bit of writing as Molly, and had that in all the way through as a possibility. But as I wrote it, I felt that what was most interesting to me was what it means to be somebody who cares for somebody else, what that means, and the fear around what was happening felt much more alive for Peggy because she was so in it, and these kind of moments of Molly losing where she is or losing what she's doing are so frightening to be next to. So I think there was something about how it feels to be the one who's trying to hold it all together rather than going totally with Molly's perspective. Although there were definitely ways I could have written, I think, the things from Molly's side. I just got more and more interested in this idea of trying to cover it up and trying to save everybody and not really understanding what was going on, but knowing there was this great danger in it. That perspective became the most alive. And then I started to introduce a subplot. I was like, well, there's any space. I haven't got any more space for voices here.
This is true, and it's so hard to talk about the subplot without without spoilers, but what I will say is that you're kind of playing with history a little bit using other historical characters we might know. I wonder whether that was that kind of subplot was an idea that came later, or did it come through kind of your research? How did that come about?
It came about partly when I started to wonder what it was that was making Molly unwell, and to try to be quite specific about what that was. Because obviously, I think writing mental illness is very difficult. Writing it through the eyes of a child witnessing it is difficult too. And so I began to think about what it could have been and to try and research anything that might have been known about it. And one of the things that came up was porphyria, which is hereditary. And once I had this idea of something hereditary, I started to get really interested in what is passed down generationally from one generation to the next, which is a theme of the book generally, I think. What's passed down from mother to mother, what we inherit, whether that's an idea or something genetic or whatever it is. So once I'd had that idea, I started to find. I'd start to look back into history and dig around, and I'd seen the idea that I have, which again I don't want to give away, but I'd
No,
seen
that's not no spoilers.
it in a couple of places, and I just thought, what it? There's no hard evidence for it, just a theory of what could have caused Molly's illness, and so I drew together these little flickers of possibility into myself.
Well, I guess as a historical fiction writer, you're always kind of playing with that gap between what we know and what you can have a go with yourself, with your own imagination. I wonder whether like that always scares me as a writer to think, I would almost feel like I needed permission to kind of play with history. But did you feel like that, or did you feel kind of comfortable once you started writing it that you were allowed to kind of have fun with this idea and this what if?
Yeah, I think there's a whole interesting ethical spectrum around writing historical fiction, and it veers from what a wonderful ethical choice to retell the stories of people who couldn't have their stories told, how brilliant you are, to what on earth are you doing messing around with real people who can't defend themselves or who can't share their story. And I don't sit in either of those places. I mean, partly perhaps because I'm also a psychotherapist, an existential psychotherapist. I read a lot of existential literature, and a lot of that is about what the past is and how the past doesn't really fundamentally exist except through our experience of it or our interpretation of it. It's only ever context. So reading a lot of that, and also the amazing Ruth lectures by Hilary Mantel, she addresses some of those questions about how there is no fundamentally no truth, really. It's all as soon as, I think she says something like, as soon as you stop living, you become fiction. which resonated with me because I've just written the ending to to my second book, although I haven't finished the book. I've just experimented with an ending, and I had a similar idea around that there's something about staying alive and that entitles us in a way to try to make sense of what went before us.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I think Hilary Mantel is the master, so you feel like whatever she'd said is the rule, is the law. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your research then. How did you kind of navigate it? Where did you begin? Did you do most of your research before you started writing, or did you kind of write and then dip back into research?
With the subplot, I had a great experience research-wise because I knew it's basically a woman on a kind of quest through 18th century London. And I loved researching that as I went. So I would read, find, I mean, I'm looking at one of the books I can see now, George in London Into the Streets, which is a great book. And I would have, I don't know, there's an incident where she works in like a kind of pig shop. And there was a diary entry from someone who'd been to a pig shop in London at the time. And the guy had been standing there with the pig like turning on the spit, and he'd had this cloth, and he'd used the same cloth, like wiped down the pig and then wiped his armpits and then wiped the pig down
Oh,
again. And so I'd read something
lovely.
like that or find something like that, and I think, well, where's Meg gonna go next? Like, how where could she go? Where could she be? So I was writing very much from a kind of literally two books in front of me, and finding these moments which sparked my imagination that she could go anywhere, do anything. Whereas the other part of the story is there is a little bit more information about what happened to the girls. It's few and far between. It's kind of a skeleton, really, because there were her, you know, the 18th century, not a lot survives. And what does survive is really just their dad's letters about them. So there wasn't so much that I could research. I did do a lot of research about Bath, I suppose, weird books that nobody would ever want to, probably the only person ever to buy, like the Great Bath Road, the history of the road from London to Bath, that kind of thing. I did, but mostly I would say I found it a really great experience as a writer because there was just enough to work from, but not so much that I was a bit overwhelmed by how much information there was to write.
And then I guess if you did have too much, you'd feel like you were forced to include it rather than actually include your own interpretation of events or what you thought might have happened or what you wanted your characters to do, because at the end of the day they are your characters and not just historical figures. One thing I have to ask, because I'm really bad at realizing this, I'm just because I'm so involved in enjoying the book, I don't realize till later, but I noticed that your sections of the book are in present tense, and that can be quite controversial for historical fiction. I love it, first thing. I'm a big fan of present tense in any form, any book. What made you go with present tense, or did it just feel natural to you to write in that way?
Yeah, I've only really realized since that some people absolutely hate it or
Yeah,
don't like
very
it. And
controversial. Yeah.
I have literally no idea. It's completely naive. But I love, maybe because it feels theatrical, it feels like you're living it. And I just love books where I feel like I'm really living it. I'm really right there. I felt like I was right there, crouching kind of by Peggy's shoulder as she goes through the world of Bath and imagine what it might be like to go into the Roman baths at that time. And all those kind of, you know, the assembly rooms in full swing or whatever it was. I loved the idea of making it, of giving it this immediacy. And I didn't, honestly, I didn't even question it. And I didn't even make a conscious choice. It just felt right.
Yeah, I love it personally. I'm a big fan. One thing that interested me when you said about talking about maybe turning it into a radio play, and I thought you would reach the same problem with that as you do with the novel, is that how do you write about something that's so visual in terms of art and artistry in a novel where you're not seeing it? You have to, as the writer, create that visual representation of being an artist, the artwork, the paintings, and also you are maybe doing it for readers who don't know the original paintings. How hard was that to do?
I kind of loved that if you wanted to, you could go and find them. So I always had that in mind that there's a possibility that once you'd heard something described or imagine what that you could literally go and look at what it was that I was looking at. But one of the things I loved about writing the book is that, say, in the book, I can imagine not only I don't only work from what I can see in the picture of the girls with the cat. I can imagine what they're looking at out at. So it opens up this kind of almost like a 4D world of all the different things, what it might have smelled like, the smells of the paint, the feel of the paint. It can take you into a completely different place. So then the painting is both, I mean, it both tells us a story and is a work of art, but it's also an object. And it's a saleable object, which is something that comes up a lot in the book, that really they've been kind of frozen and they generate cash, or they are used as adverts, really, the equivalent of an advert, for Gainsborough to sell more paintings. So I think there's a lot to unpack that maybe we don't get just from the picture about what the sum total of it is and what the relationship is of the father to the daughters and the daughters to the father, and as they grow older, kind of how that relationship changes, and yeah, as the relationships change, what does he see differently? What can he see that we can't? So I found it fueling rather than alarming. Sort of
Yeah.
opened up.
What was then the hardest part of the novel to write? What did you find particularly challenging? Well, obviously it was your first ever attempt. So, what for you was the thing that was maybe the hardest struggle to get over?
Definitely my own voices of self-criticism would be the first thing, and they're still with me, and they're still with me as I try and write the second book. And I think that voice that just wants to tear down everything you've done is a real killer, because if you start to get into that headspace where everything's rubbish and the whole book is rubbish, which usually I think strikes around the middle somewhere, when you're kind of in the midsection, you're like, oh my God, it's going to pieces, trying to kind of get a grip on that voice, because I think it does it yeah, it can be a killer in terms of wanting to keep creating. It's too it's very strong. So that, and then I would say I just think it's all about the middle. I think the middle's really hard, and in the middle of mine I was definitely trying to build the intensity of the danger all around them, and Molly's condition worsening, and that sort of coming apart at the seams, and trying to sustain that tension really. And that was the one bit I ended up cutting quite a lot from. I think I took about 10 or 15,000 words from the middle section, because I just wanted to keep it really, really pacey. So yeah, I think tension in the middle, sagginess is
Yeah,
my.
we always talk about sagging middle, don't we? I think there's that
Yes.
moment where you, like you say, you have a crisis of confidence and think
Yeah.
you've reached a point where you almost can't go back, but going
Yeah.
forward seems terrifying.
Yes, just stuck.
We talked about how you haven't written a novel before, but you've had a very kind of creative background in terms of your career. Can you talk a little bit about how you think maybe your other careers or your work on other projects has kind of helped build you as an author?
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah, I feel really lucky because when I came out of university and was really confused, as I think everyone is for a couple of years, I ended up finding this amazing place, which is like a school for actors who want to write. And it just took all of the fear and all of the horror out of trying to write something and made writing totally. So, for example, someone walking onto a stage and sitting on a chair, that's writing. How do they do it? Does it squeak? Do they, are they scared of the chair? What happens? You're already writing, was kind of the feeling of the school. And so that's really stayed with me, that just don't stop the movement. It's easier than you think. Can you make us laugh? Can you make us cry? You're already writing. Whatever you're doing, you're basically writing something. So that has stayed with me, like a kind of ease to it. The, trying to banish, I say that someone clearly terrified of failure or like getting it wrong or very self-critical, but to be able to fight that voice down, I think you kind of say, yeah, just fail at it, have a go at it. It's not as dramatic or as intellectually terrifying as you think it is. That's stayed with me. But the other thing that really has saved me from that school was about engaging the senses and writing through the body. It's like a physical theatre school. And so I ran a theatre company for quite a long time after that, which we wrote together and in a way quite kind of similar because we told stories from the past. So my own grandmother's story, and then we told a story set in the Basque country because we had a couple of Basque company members. So the history of Spain, a dictatorship and all that stuff. And that was a kind of like a gay love story under Franco. And then we would tell them in the round with like a ch maybe like a cello in the corner. And then we do all the sound in the corners of the stage, like dripping buckets and to make a cellar and very kind of immersive. And I just loved telling stories that way. And the guy would always, the head teacher would say, oh, this is a radio play. If it was kind of drab or boring or he was quite critical about it. So I think I've kept that with me. Like, I don't want it to read like, a kind of flat set of intellectual ideas on a page, or to become so obsessed with what I, how clever my book is that I lose track of, can I make us laugh? Can I make us cry? Can I tell a story that's great and really immerse you in it completely? So those things stay with me. And I guess the general ability, hopefully, to structure a story that keeps going, because in theatre, pretty quickly if it gets boring, it's obvious that it's boring. And in novels, you just don't want people giving up halfway through and putting it down and thinking, oh, we're sure people do that sometimes. But try to kind of like get that whatever it is that keeps that theatricality that keeps you wanting to watch.
I was going to ask you actually about your career as a director and when working in theatre, and I wondered whether that kind of helped you approach movement, because I sometimes feel like, particularly when writers start out and they're we've all done it where you've written dialogue and your characters are just sort of static or not doing anything. And do you think that your work in the theatre helped you think more about kind of bodies and movement and like trying not to make your scenes too still?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess I was always attracted to that way of thinking about stuff, or I wouldn't have ended up there in the first place. So it's partly who I am. But there's certain things that we used to work with, say characters attracting and repelling, like magnets, or pushing and pulling, or and how much story you could get before and after words was always the goal. So before and after language was this huge thing, and I think that also plays out in you can tell so much just by somebody moving or by the kind of push and pull between two people in a space. I think that does give a bit of movement to books. That is how people are really, when we are essentially like sort of living bodies in the world. And I think relationship plays out like that.
Yeah, I always think that, well, personally, the way I try and think when I'm writing is to try and picture what I'm writing as film, because I know other people work in different ways, but I remember having some writing advice that was like, plant yourself in the scene and like look around and kind of imagine it as a like a real space, because sometimes you get lost in just your own head and it's very hard to kind of imagine pe real people and real things in the world when you're just staring at a screen with some text on. So yeah, I think that I can imagine that would be really helpful to your process. I know you've had success with short form and short stories, and you said you initially thought that was kind of your thing. Did you approach the writing of this novel then with the kind of almost with the way, same way you would approach writing a short story, or did you have it consciously in your head like this is going to be so much bigger and so much harder, or did you try and think about it in the same way?
Well, that's such a good question. I think there's something about a feeling that for me generates the writing. There's the visual part of it totally. And I was going to say, I can feel that very much in your writing. So I'm loving the sea
Thank
women,
you.
and I feel the same thing. And it, I feel the same sense of immersion and the same sense of it being very visual and very real. So there's that partly, like something might inspire that, or a location or a setting or a moment or whatever. But I think that when I'm writing both a novel and a short story, what they have in common is that there's a feeling that I want to run through them, either a place where I'm going to end, say, like I've written a million novels, but with my first novel and then a novel I'm doing now, I think I sort of have a feeling about where I want it to end. Like, even if I couldn't put it into words, like a kind of painful feeling or a beautiful feeling or a bit of both or something that is driving it underneath. And I feel the same about short story writing. So I just wrote a short story about a driving instructor, and it's got that same, and it's a driving instructor who taught his daughter to drive, and she's been in an accident, and he's just watching her in the hospital, and it's unbearable. And so this feeling of like exactly, and it's a different feeling to a different story about a different character. I have this exact like color of feeling that is Jeffrey's color of feeling, and like that's what kind of unites, I think, both forms. It's just that one takes absolutely ages. Very
That's so
quick.
fun. That's so interesting. I was listening to a podcast and I can't remember the author now, but she was saying that she, when she's kind of mapping out her novel, she maps out kind of not obviously just the story, but also kind of her character's emotional journey, but also the journey she wants the reader to go on, like how she wants the reader to be feeling at certain points. I think that's really interesting to be thinking about. Makes it harder to kind of think about all those things at the same time. Maybe that's just experience where you kind of get to that point, and both of us have only written one book, so maybe we're not at that point yet.
Yeah, sounds very challenging. Because
Yeah,
also, how can you know?
I know. Well, I guess it's more intention than reality, but I suppose we do know to an extent what we want readers to feel, because otherwise we wouldn't know what to write. We're trying to evoke something in the atmosphere or the kind of dialogue or something. So I suppose we do know deep down, but it's mapping out is another level. I have to ask you about one of your biggest successes, which was winning the Ms. Lexia Novel Award in 2021. I'd love to hear about that experience, how you entered, what made you enter, and then kind of what that win did for you in terms of your career.
Yes, I think I entered because of the same question that dogs me constantly, which is this any good, basically. And there's something about a competition that gives you a sense of where you are before. And obviously, with novels, you can't really have an answer to that question until you've got the whole novel. No one will give you one. So, agents won't give you one, publishers won't give you one. But you will not get the answer. You might get a friend to read it, but then is that really the answer? I don't know. So, there's something really about the honesty of competitions that I really love. And I probably entered because I had about, I don't know, 10,000 words. And I thought, well, I'll just throw my 5,000 words in and see if it's any good. And then went from that place. I did know that it was judged by Hilary Mantel, and obviously that created some consternation because it's historical fiction, and I was a bit unsure how that would go. Felt a bit death or glory. But I was, and then once they do that, then they say, can we have the next bit? And then can we have, and eventually I got the long listing, and they were like, can we have the entire novel? And I didn't have the entire novel. They gave me a date a little bit ahead, and I had like a really, and I remember my writing group going, come on, you can do it. I was thinking, oh, just don't, just you cannot. They were really cheering me on over the finish line. They were like, just write it, just write it.
Was
And
it a
it
really
that really
short space of time?
something like a month, yeah, month and a
Wow,
half
okay, yeah.
maybe. They were generous in that they gave you a little bit of notice, but it was a huge sprint. I had a hospital appointment at one point, like an operation, and I went in for the operation. I was on the hospital bed with my gown like open at the back, with my laptop out, banging on
Now
the laptop to try and get it done.
that is dedication.
So intense. Yeah, I'm really obviously massively glad that I did. And then to have Hilary Mantel as the judge, and to have her wonderful words about the book, I think has changed the Well, I don't know if it's changed. It feels like it's changed the course of the book for me. Really grateful to everything about that competition. I think they, particularly Miss Lexia, who was so wonderful, like I said in the back of my book, that they kind of re-democratize writing. It makes it so open. And I've recommended it to lots of other people who want to write, because there's something about it. When you read it as a magazine, you feel that the opportunities are everywhere, there's a community here, and that you're not alone, which really feels like the most important thing, doesn't it, as a writer, keep you going.
Yeah, I really enjoy it as well. It's a great magazine, and I don't know about you, but I take very sad. I take so many photos on my phone of like pages of the magazine that I think they're gonna come in handy one day, and they're gonna really like inspire me. Like my phone is filled with photos of the pages because I don't have enough space to keep like all the copies. So what I'll do is I'll take photos of like stuff that I think is gonna come in handy one day. Yeah, so I've just got like hundreds of Miss Lexia photos on my phone. But yeah, it's a great magazine, and they do so much for, like you say, competitions. They do showcases, they do so many things. So yeah, if you're a woman, I would really recommend subscribing or looking it up. So did your win with the competition lead to you getting an agent?
No. So again, because I have this question, is it any good, in my head, as soon as I had another opportunity to find that out, once I'd finished it and submitted it to Miss Lexia, I did a really naughty, kind of cheeky, well, I could just send it to just a couple of agents, now it's a full manuscript, and just see. And if there's no response and they don't like it, at least I'll have a sort of sense of what might need to change, or might get some feedback or something. So the day after I'd sent it to Miss Lexia, I naughtily sent it away to an agent, and they asked for the full. And then once they'd asked for the full, I thought, oh God, I better have some other options on the table, otherwise I'll just be set with this relationship. So basically, I got the agent in between sending the full. Once I had a full manuscript, I just went straight to agents, and it went from there. And then the competition I won a little bit later on, a couple of months after that, I think.
Oh, okay, so you weren't kind of winning and then querying. You kind of did it in between.
Yeah, I mean,
Okay.
ridiculous and cheeky of me, but there's something
But
so lovely once you've got a full manuscript back and answer.
in some ways that's nice because you know then it's not just the kind of shiny competition win that attracted them to your writing. It was the writing full stop. Although obviously, as I say, I pretty much say this in every episode, when someone's won or been shortlisted for a competition, enter the competitions. Like you never know what's going to happen. Like you could get agent representation. You could even just chat to an agent, and it helps you get a foot in the door. And I think that's the best thing to do is to just enter everything, even if you like you, Emily, hadn't finished the novel at that point. There's a month to write it in. You know, you've got time when you're in your hospital bed.
Just do it, because also it's so subjective, and you might win one competition, and I'm sure I entered another novel competition and didn't get anywhere. So it really is totally not, I wouldn't say it was a lottery, because obviously there must be some element of quality in
Yeah,
the
don't
judging.
do yourself down.
Say that, but I would definitely say that the more, I've had, same with short stories, I'd submit the same short story to a few different places, and some of them wouldn't want it and some of them would love it. It's like anything. And so just keep entering, because each little thing is a kind of brick of confidence that can carry you forward.
Yeah, definitely. I love that brick of confidence that carries you forward. Oh, I need that on a t-shirt or some like inspirational poster, I think, above my desk. So I'd love if you could kind of give us a little insight into how the publishing experience has been for you and what advice you would give to the next lot of debut writers that are waiting in the wings about how to kind of deal with all the publishing weirdness, the ups and downs, the kind of the very the I guess a very closed off industry because it's you start it not really knowing how it will work. So what would your advice be about how to kind of cope with that weird 18 months before your book comes out?
I would say other writers are wonderful, basically, and that has been my experience of it, that every writing group or group of writers I've been part of have been fantastic for that. Sharing, kind of commiserating, championing. I've been blown away by how much people do that for each other, and how many voices of support. People are really willing to be vocal for each other, and to champion each other, basically, That's fantastic. And that's got me through lots of strange moments where things have been wobbly or I've been unsure, or because it is an emotion, it's bumpy emotionally. I've had a pretty good run of it, and I've been very lucky, I think, with my first book. And even through that process, there have been times when it's been tough or I've been really tired. And I think also the thing about, especially about other debut writers, if you can get into a group with some of those, I've heard it can go badly, but it's not been my experience at all. There's just something about it. I think we were saying beforehand that like all your friends and family expect you to be sort of permanently thrilled about everything that's happening all the time. And every conversation is someone nodding at you like you're just going to be constantly in a state of pure thrill for like 2 years. And so being able to be in a group of people who are experiencing that too, and to say, God, I just do not feel thrilled today at all. I feel really terrible and sad, and I can't get going with my second one, I don't know why, and have other voices go, oh God, me too, come on, you know, I'm here as well, let's all make jokes about it. I think that is brilliant. So that's my number one top tip, just collaborate and be part of groups and support other people. Beyond that, I think be prepared for it to feel up and down and be ready for that. And anything else that I would say to people about to embark on it, I'm not going to say anything like enjoy it or anything like that, because everyone will tell you to enjoy it constantly. Stand up for yourself. I would say stand up for yourself. Don't feel that because you are beginning you don't understand what's going on and you should be quiet about it. I think if you can speak up, ask, try and get information and make it clear you want to hear all the information if you can, I think that's probably a good tip.
Yeah, that's a great bit of advice. So you did hint at it just then, but finally, Emily, are you able to give us any hints about what you're working on at the moment?
Oh yes, I can. I can even give you a title. So Mrs. Dickens is my second book.
Oh, amazing.
And it is the life of Kate Dickens, who is one of the most sort of neglected and kind of ignored figures you could possibly imagine. She was married to Charles, obviously, had 10 kids with Charles, and this life, she wrote a cookbook, she's a great cook, and then he left her for an actress when they'd been married for 22 years, I think. He left her for Ellen Ternan, he was much younger, and basically kind of cast her off. So he said something like, a page in my life which once had writing on it is now completely blank and has not a single word upon it. He just decided she wasn't going to be spoken about anymore, and did lots of sort of very sneaky things to ensure that she was kind of erased. But also, I think a lot of the reason she was erased is because we still hold a lot of judgment about women. For example, she pops up in The Invisible Woman, which is the film about Nellie Ternan and Dickens and their love affair. And like Ralph Fiennes is being Dickens by candlelight somewhere and sort of glances up and you just see that his wife is getting changed. And the inference is, oh, well, she's quite fat, so probably we all understand why he's going for this actress, was kind of his kind of the filmic vibe. And so I'm really interested in how we all collude in stories about what's valuable, that somehow, I mean, you know, autistic Dickens with his frenetic energy is of course valuable, but somehow the other part of life, which is perhaps, I don't know, living, having children, cooking, eating, food, being, just being, is not seen as having any inherent value or is dismissible. And the way that women as they age become dismissible too. So I feel like there's lots to open up about that. And what marriage is, why we get married, why we stay married, and what happens when marriages end.
That sounds amazing. That sounds so good. You said you've played with an ending, so how far through are you? And you're not at the end yet, I know that, but how many words have you written, can you share?
I've written about 80,000.
Wow. So you are close to the end then.
You'd think, wouldn't you? Would think.
Well, no, I say the end, as we all know. The end is not the end. The end is like part one of seven, and then you've got to do, you know, hundreds of edits and rounds of passes and to be fair, I love the editing process. I don't know why I'm dismissing it. I really enjoy that part of it, so but that sounds really great. But I know, well, you've got the endorsement from Hilary Mantel for your first novel, and really excited to see the rest of your career flourish, Emily. But thank you for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a real treat.
That was Emily Howes talking about her historical novel, The Painter's Daughters, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited-edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.